Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
Welcome to the new Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter with CCW Safe in Oklahoma City. I got Stan Campbell, COO, on the line from lovely LA. How is it out there, Stan?
It's always beautiful and crowded.
But beautiful and crowded. Nice. Weather been nice?
Weather's always nice.
Have you been on the firing line lately?
I did a guest host on the firing line about a week and a half ago.
And yeah, that's on our. I believe that's on our site, right? When you hosted it with Kyle?
Yes, sir. That's the one we did with Kyle.
Nice.
Believe it or not, California's our number two state. People don't realize how, large the state is and really how they are supported by, some of the larger counties
for
concealed carry. So we're real happy about that.
So we're gonna start. We've been running the In Self-Defense podcast with Don West and Sean Vincent. And we're gonna start an Inside CCW Safe podcast more for our members, for non-members, but really diving into kind of the history of CCW Safe, of the people within us, our affiliates, some of the people that we work with, and hopefully we got a pretty good line of shows out. We also have a special 4-episode series with Stephen Maddox, who we defended last summer. So there's a lot to talk about. Tomorrow, Kyle Sweet and myself are going to be recording another one on the firearms industry and the state of the firearms industry right now. But this first one, I think, Stan, we wanted to start with kind of the history of CCW Safe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And then probably the best way to do this, because it was your brainchild, I want to do an interview style. So I'll ask you some questions and we'll see how that goes and we'll kind of mix it up.
Sure.
Okay. So first, Mike, if you don't mind, give us a touch on your background and a little bit of mine.
Okay. So Stan and I actually went through the police academy together in Oklahoma City back in 1991. I was a police officer there for 10 years. Stan remained on the department for over 20 years, retired lieutenant on the police department. I left at 10 years and started some contract work with the DOJ. I was working for the ATF out of Dallas, managing a violent crimes program for North Texas and Oklahoma. And so I guess as far as the history, history?
So Mike, if you would, because the history is based upon the experience of, the founders and also all the staff members being former law enforcement.
Right.
So let's kind of talk about, before you get into your incident, can you kind of explain when officers are involved in a shooting, can you kind of explain what happens there?
Yeah. So, and there's been a lot of changes over the last 20 years. But when officers are involved in a shooting, it's first of all, we'll just talk about the incident and the response. An officer-involved shooting is one of those incidents that everybody available on that department is going to respond to. There's going to be a massive response. There's going to be a response of police officers, of investigators, supervisors, possibly even the police chief or upper command. There's going to be a response by the Fraternal Order of Police, as the the president of the FOP is most likely going to respond. There's going to be attorneys out that are on retainer with the FOP, and it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be something that it is not going to be processed quickly. And one of the things with officer involved shootings is that over time it's become more and more common for police officers who are involved in a shooting to be not interviewed for 24 to 48 hours. So they're going to be given some time because of the critical stress, the physiological effects that exist after a critical stress incident. So they're going to be given some time to calm down. They're going to be given time to get their memory back in order and to have legal representation with them. Absolutely. Now, there's some departments that still actually don't do that. They do take like immediate statements, but in most of those cases, I would say if not all those cases, they are also given a chance to come back in later and review that report for any mistakes. And that's the way mine was when I, Gary Eastridge, who is now our critical response team coordinator and our affiliate manager, he, at the time of my shooting, he was a homicide detective and he was the one who interviewed me. He interviewed me and then I was able to come back in later on, you know, a few days later and kind of review the report and make sure that everything was correct. But it's gone now more common to where they're not interviewed directly after the shooting.
Yes, and they have like many more studies that have been done over the past couple of years that are making the larger departments move in that direction because they're learning so much. Because like Mike said, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s, they shot someone, used deadly force. They probably take, they'll take their weapon for just a couple of hours, you know, take some shots just to, you know, verify that it was their gun and then give it back to them. Someone will start work the same day or the next day.
Oh, yeah. That was common.
It's changed so much. Yeah, it's changed so much, especially with the political atmosphere that's out there right now. I want to go back, Mike. You know, like people don't realize that when you get involved in a shooting incident, it absolutely changes your life. And it's something that officers actually dread. No one wants to be involved in a shooting. You know, although people think that, you know, we run around and everyone's trigger happy, that's the last thing that officers want to be involved in.
Right.
Is the actual shooting that takes somebody's life. I went 20 years without doing so. You were 10 years in and you had at least one.
Mm-hmm.
So take us back for, if you don't mind, go back to your incident and then let's, you know, give them a little briefing about it.
Yeah. And one thing too, Stan, is, you know, if you think back, how many times as a police officer could you have used deadly force with a firearm?
And yeah, I mean, if I were to guess, and like all of us are the same. I mean, those who get out and work, especially those who work really hard or in, you know, some of the specialized units like you and I were. We were both in impact. You went to the gang unit. I became a supervisor in impact. So we did a lot of drug raids and dealt with a lot of bad people and dangerous people. We've had people pull guns on us. We have people shoot at us, you know, all the above. And, you know, because I teach a de-escalation program, I kind of, you know, pulled it out and decided that it was just about a little over 3,000 people that I pulled my gun on. And there's about 10 incidents in which I had my finger on the trigger, you know, yelling at someone to drop a gun or a knife. And I was just about to pull the trigger because of the situation. And then something changed. And, you know, I didn't do it. So there's at least 10 times in my career in 20 years that I could have taken someone's life that did not. Doesn't mean that I should not have. It's just that things changed so that I did. So I know you've had incidents like that as well, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I had, you know, especially in the gang unit. I mean, there were a lot of times. One in particular, I remember a guy, he had a gun. He's trying to get out of his waistband and I had to pin against a car. And, you know, I had my firearm drawn pushing into him there was a police officer standing right behind him. So, you know, yeah. I couldn't really shoot. And I remember trying to drive it downward. And as I did, there was a female passenger sitting right behind him. And it's just a bad situation. Luckily, you know, he couldn't get the gun out. I heard it hit the ground and it was over. And like you say, things change so fast that. And because we were, you know, constantly training back then, and because we were, you know, when you and I were on, when you were in Impact or on the street toward 10th Street, you know, we got into things like that all the time. It wasn't, it was a constant training environment, really. And so things changed so fast that you're able to deal with that. Now, today I wouldn't be, I'd be so out of practice that I would, you know, I wouldn't want to be put in one of those situations like that now. But back then it was pretty common for us, you know.
Yes.
For you and I and a lot of the other guys we worked with. But, yeah, it could have there could have been a lot of shootings. And that's one of the things that, you know, no matter what you get from the news stories or these other, you know, online stories that are out there, I don't think anybody is going around looking to get into a shooting. Because it really does. It changes your life. It also... I mean, you just think about just on a daily task, what all things would change, not for that day, but probably over the for the next week or two, any plans you have are done, are changed. And then you have long-term changes and family, and it's just not desirable.
Absolutely.
For officers to be in.
Taking a step back in yesteryear, you were involved in your shooting in 96, I believe?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was 1 year after the bombing.
Team at that time, right?
What's that?
It was you on the Impact team?
Yeah, so I was on an Impact team. Stan mentioned Impact before. Stan was on an Impact team, but he's also a supervisor of Impact team. And Impact was implementing multiple police actions against criminal targets. And it was a did you know that, Stan?
I did know that.
You did know that. All right.
Of course.
I figured you knew that. Yeah, but yeah, there are always multiple, the acronyms seem to change from time to time. But but we were a plainclothes unit. We had 6 to 8 men and women who were on a team, and we would just work. Oklahoma City is basically divided into 4 subdivisions, and so we'd work our subdivision as a street level felony crimes unit, dealing a lot with gang activity and drug activity. But then we had, I remember, you know, during the once October, November rolled around, we'd set up on robbery stuff, burglary stuff. So it was kind of it was a great team. It was a fun team to be a part of. The division that I was part of was East Side Oklahoma City, which was heavily was drug trafficking, drug investigations. So we ran, I think the 2 years we were there, I ran around 400 entries, most of those probably of which were immediate entry, high-risk search warrants. And so I was always number two man in. And on one particular night, we had good information that there was a firearm involved. And when we hit the house, he drew that firearm and ended up getting a shooting. My partner, number one man, was immediately attacked from another, from one of the hallways, ended up getting another shooting in the same little micro incident. And so ended up shooting and killing 2 people. We were, you know, we went through, we were off for a short amount of time. I remember going down, you know, I remember coming out of the house, and I remember Glenn Holcomb, and I remember just, it was like half the department was there already. You know, I mean, they were just pouring in. I called my mom, and I had to tell her. I said, my stepdad was a former Navy pilot, and so he knew, you know, I mean, I knew he'd understand. So she answered. I was like, "Hey, Mom, how you doing?" I was sitting in the back of the scout car. I was like, "Hey, can I talk to Bob?" And she put him on. I was just like, "Don't let Mom watch the news. Don't let Mom watch the news. Don't let Mom watch the news tonight." And because I didn't know exactly what, you know, we just hit the house. We didn't know what we were going to get, if anything, you know, didn't know what the news was going to be. Luckily, mm-hmm. it was like 1 year almost. It was April 6th, so it was right before the first anniversary of the bombing, first year anniversary. So that kind of, you know, sucked all the heat off of us as far as the news yeah. and media. But, you know, at that time, like I said, I went down to homicide, did an interview, you know, went, took my gun in, did the test fire. You know, I got it back immediately. We were off for about 3 months just because there was one, you know, that one guy on the upper management who had, you know, I don't know about this. And, you know,
that one guy,
there's always that one guy, but you know, Bob Macy, who was a DA, he was sending letters over, hey, you got to put these guys back to work. And long story short, yeah. It was justified shooting pretty much immediately. But about 2 years after that, I was sued in federal court, myself and Mike Kelly, the other officer, and the department. That they did go punitive. They were going punitive on us, from what I recall. And it got kicked out at summary judgment. Mm-hmm. But that took about a year and a half to get to, which I probably would have estimated maybe around $200,000.
Correct.
As a cost.
So, what do you estimate and I know the DA was pretty much on your side on that shooting. Mm-hmm. But what do you think your estimate on the cost of the criminal trial? Oh, no, sorry, the criminal proceedings, because you didn't really go that far.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't have anything because there were no criminal. There were
no criminal allegations.
Yeah, they declined to file immediately. Okay. But the whole deal was internal, which was an administrative. Gosh. And yeah. It's kind of funny because, so this is an example. So CCWSF does criminal, civil, and administrative. So what I went through is administrative, but as far as a civilian, it might be like the state trying to take your, permit away. But it was an administrative investigation basically, and it was all about target identification. It was kind of funny because the day before the warrant that we ran, we did a drill out at with the attack team with Bruce and those guys, and it was on target identification, but nobody wrote anything down, so there were no scores. But that was one of the things, and it was just one of, you know, those guys' things where that one guy mm-hmm. had a problem, not really a problem, but saying, you know, I think we need to look at this. This is,
yeah.
you know, didn't go anywhere.
Okay. And then so the civil, so you estimated it'd be about how much that was spent on your civil defense?
Yeah, I would say probably a couple hundred thousand in my estimate. I don't know how much it was because, you know, as a Fraternal Order of Police member, they took care of everything. I mean, so we had, you know, we had attorneys that we hired. They had the city mm-hmm. attorney, but then we also had our attorneys, which were covered by the FOP. We had an awesome expert witness, mm-hmm. Charles Higby, Chuck Higby from LAPD came in. He was, I don't know if he's even still around, but he was one of the Frozen Chosen back yes. from Chosun Reservoir back in the Korean War. He was a LAPD homicide detective. Man, I don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands of shootings he worked with LAPD. But he was an expert witness. I learned more from him in just a 2 day going through 4 seconds in 2 days than I learned in any class that I'd ever been in. But we mm-hmm. had investigators. I remember they were working on back then a computer animated type reenactment. Mm-hmm. At the time it was dismissed. So, you know, I would say probably a couple hundred thousand. Dollars.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the norm now. I mean, it's actually gone up, of course. That was '96, so we're probably about $400,000, you know, for a
yeah.
serious injury to
yep.
death case. So, moving on to that, you left Oklahoma City, but in just before you left Oklahoma City, was that in 2010?
That was 2009. It was in 2001. It was 91 to 2001 with Oklahoma City.
Okay. So you're about to leave Oklahoma City, and when did you come up with the brainchild of CCW Safe? Because you were trying to find something that was similar to what we had on the police department, correct?
Yeah, so that was actually in 2011 when I left. So from 2001 to 2011, I was with ATF out of Dallas.
Gotcha.
And when I left there, I moved back to Oklahoma City. That's when I had decided that I really needed to look for something myself, because we had accumulated, you know, a little wealth. I was in a much different place before. I had three young girls. I was going to carry. And I thought, you know, I need some kind of coverage because I'm not going to be able to have the same coverage that I did before.
Yes.
So Kyle, I had a talk with Kyle, who's our general counsel, and said, hey, I need something, some kind of coverage. And we talked about it a little bit, and he said, yeah, let me look around. He was a former police officer. My stepbrother, Kyle Sweet, and we grew up together. He was an officer. At this time, he was an attorney working catastrophic civil cases, and he called about 3 days later and said, hey, man, there's nothing out there. He said, there's several programs that are insurance-based, but, you know, you're really not going to get any assistance until you're going to have to get reimbursed, and you're going to have to pay for your own trial, and then be found not guilty, and there's really nothing there. We need to look at this. We need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we started looking, and then that's at the time when you came in as well. We all looked at it. We decided that we did not want to be an insurance-based product, number one, because it's not a reimbursement model is not helpful at the time of when you need that. And secondly, we didn't want to be a insurance model because of what we're seeing right now in the firearms industry, or in this industry, where it's, you know, insurance is, it's illegal for insurance to cover an intentional act, when that's what we've seen out of New York. So there are, you know, some good reasons why we didn't. We wanted to be a legal service provider, which is what we see the FOP as, because they provided legal services. It wasn't an insurance. It was a membership.
Correct.
So
yeah.
That's how we developed it. It took us about a year to develop. Really by 2012, 13, I think we hit the ground running with it. And
yes. So 2012, because I know you don't even want to think about this, but 2012, that was back when Mike and I, you know, we were just trying to get the word out. And he and I would go to gun shows just trying to, you know, push out. So it was pretty much, you know, it was us two going to gun shows and trying to push our product. And there was a few out there at the time, and no one had heard of us. But, you know, 2012 was, you know, not much activity. And then, you know, following that was the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin shooting. And, you know, right about, you know, mid-2013, is when the trial was happening, going on, and everybody had their eyes on it. Now, I'm going to say this part, and then we're going to back up and talk about our structure. But then, you know, Mike and I kind of looked at what was going on and how much attention was on self-defense shootings at the time, and we just knew it was just important to get our name out there and advertise big at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we kind of popped our cherry there.
Yeah.
For lack of a phrase. But so then we step started going. Now, backing it up, let's talk about why we made the decisions that we did on the police union model, and you know, some things that are like specific to it, and how we changed the industry, because we talked about reinsurance products.
Yep.
We said we weren't going to do that. They were all covering firearms.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty much giving you a list of attorneys, and that's about it. That was pretty much the model.
Yeah.
So we changed, and how do we do that?
Well, so, you know, at that time, the heavy emphasis was on attorneys and legal, and that was really about it. There wasn't any, I mean, and I remember seeing videos, and there's still probably a lot out there say, don't say anything. Don't say, don't talk to police, don't say anything. Well, having the experience of both sides, of having the experience from attorneys and people who work criminal and catastrophic civil cases, and having the side on law enforcement, that added kind of a different dimension to it, really, because that was something that it was all up to that point. It was all about the attorneys.
You're right.
You know,
let me jump in real quick.
Yeah.
You know, what was out there at the time, and I'm not going to name anybody, but you know who they are. You had a organization that, you know, were heavy on politics and defending the Second Amendment. You had an organization that their background was publications, and they had an awesome magazine, and they just kind of did insurance on the side, their reimbursement plan. And then you had an organization that was in one of our larger states that were run by attorneys. And, you know, they had a good foothold in their state, but they didn't, you know, cover you nationwide.
Right.
So go ahead.
So, yeah, just we brought another kind of dimension to that. And, you know, like it or not, the attorneys work off of the product of investigators in a shooting case. And we saw that with Stephen Maddox this last year. You know, we immediately upon hiring the attorneys, what's the first thing we did? After we had bail, then we had the attorneys, we immediately hired a private investigator. And you know what? Within a few months, we had $45,000 worth of investigative work. But that's what led that case. That's what created the work product for them. And having people who have investigated these crimes, that have an idea, a good idea of how the criminal justice system works, on the side of the police departments who are going to be investigating you as our member if you ever involved in a shooting, that brought a whole new dimension to it.
Absolutely.
And because of our experience in that, like you said, we have over 75 years experience between all of us. You have 20, I have 20. Gary Eastridge has 30 some years. Kyle has, you know, about 5 years. So, you know, to have somebody like Gary who has investigated hundreds of homicides, you know, for Oklahoma City, and then he was on the UN team in Kosovo investigating homicides and training their officers for 2 years, and then he came back and for the last 10 years being the chief investigator for the DA's office, investigating officer-involved shootings and all shootings and high-level, high-profile cases. Having somebody like that on your side, along with a top-notch attorney, that's a pretty good team.
Absolutely. And then if you think about it, you know, the smaller units that we've come from, it made it just perfect in the way that we designed CCW Safe, because in essence, CCW Safe is pretty much a shooting team that floats around the United States. You know, that's why we created a critical response team. But, you know, but also is smart enough to team up with local attorneys and investigators and such to service our members. And, you know, understanding that and the critical incident system, you know, it was easy for us to design a response element that was different than anything out there. I mean, to include, you know, at the time when we came out, the other organizations, they had like an emergency phone that they passed around staff members. But we decided, because everybody was familiar with 911 system, and so were we understood the importance of locking in the information with a 24-hour call center and having somebody wide awake, not that you have to wake them up, and then connecting you directly to an attorney, patching you through so that you can have the privileged call. And nobody understood that. You know, they attempted to make it seem as if it was not proper. It actually is. It's actually better. So moving on to a couple of things that makes us stand, we stand apart from our competitors.
Well, that's, I think the biggest thing early on was the dimension of having a good understanding of not just what criminal charges and the you know, criminal defense law regarding firearms and deadly uses of force, but also having that dimension of understanding how the investigation goes, what they're going to be looking for, what they're going to be, how they're going to be going about the investigation, gathering information, having all that. The second biggest thing, I think, for us was, and it's two part, but really the biggest thing was Don, but having a good understanding of catastrophic cases and dealing with the civil side. But the real big thing for us when Stan, you mentioned Zimmerman earlier, the Zimmerman case going on. When that was over, we had, and we still have a relationship with Bob O'Connor, who was one of the Correct. Chief investigators over the Zimmerman case at the time.
Correct.
And so we were doing some courses, kind of a training course at some of the ranges in Florida, and it was on the Zimmerman trial, and we had Bob, and I remember doing the one in, I think it was in Orlando we did, and at that range, and Bob called and said, "Hey, would it be okay if Don West came tonight?" And I was like, "You mean Don West as in Don West, the guy who just tried the case?" And he said, "Yeah." And I was like, that'd be great. I'd love to meet him." And and he came, and he was just a awesome guy. He was very nice. He was very open to what we were doing. He was very open to, I mean, he ended up, you know, taking questions from all those people that were in that course and answering them, taking his time. And I was like, wow, this guy, I mean, number one, he was the guy. And now he's here at this course, and he's, you know, answering questions. And so it wasn't too long after that that we established a rapport and relationship with him. And not too long after that is when he became part of our team.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to catch you guys up, you know, we're pretty much broken into, and when we're talking about our response, we have legal, we have the investigative and the administrative response, and all of that happens for you simultaneously when you call for assistance. So it's not just one person working for you. It's not just the attorney that you call. It's our entire team, and we are all up, and just like we would respond to a police shooting, we do the same thing for you guys, working on logistics, trying to get the right people there, trying to work with your family. And we did a lot of that with the Maddox case. And we were able, because he's the first that actually had, really in the nation, that almost used every aspect of our services, you know, from beginning to end, and everything except for civil. And, it's just amazing, you know, how we operate as compared to the others. You know, the others, they still believe that, and they use, you know, these catchphrases like Second Amendment, friendly attorneys, and list of attorneys, and you know, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day if you have, you know, 40,000 attorneys across the nation. What truly matters is you have attorneys that are experts and experienced in use of force cases, shooting cases, and actually have trial experience. You know, because a lot, I mean, it actually doesn't happen as often as people would think. And, you know, for those that and Don, just like you mentioned, talked about, you know, his experience level is really high, over 35 years.
35 years, yeah.
In business and on both levels, in state and federal.
Yeah, he's one of the few attorneys that's tried death penalty cases in both state and federal. I mean, there's not too many of those guys around. He's not just the Zimmerman case. I mean, he has 35 years of cases like that, and he has the most experience in self-defense law, and he's the one who vets and who finds our attorneys, and it's a whole and we'll get into the response. I think we're going to actually have one whole podcast on the response. So, and that's one thing kind of want everybody to know and kind of get prepared for, because we want to look for you guys. We want questions from you guys. We want input from you guys. We want our listeners to be able to be, interactive with this. So we're going to be doing in the future, we're going to be doing a podcast interview with Don on his history. We'll do one with Kyle Sweet, our general counsel, on his history. We'll do one with Alexis Artwall, who Alexis Artwall is another key part of our team. Her book, Surviving Deadly Encounters, was more for police, and that's where I, after my shooting, I became more aware and more interested in that critical response effort. And so I knew about her from far before we started this. And, when I reached out to her, luckily she believed in what we were doing, and she was on board, pretty early, and she's been awesome. She's an amazing woman. She's, done a lot of the studies in officer-involved shootings over the past 20 years. We're going to do an interview with her history. We'll probably have, some of the other people who we deal with often, Larry Vickers. We'll try to get some of these other people on to get some history, so not only the history of the company, but history of everybody involved. And then from there, we'll go on, in with Steven Maddox and with maybe some of our other people, because we've had a lot more than Steven Maddox. Steven Maddox is definitely the biggest that we've had. He's the only full self-defense murder one trial in the industry. But we'll have some others. And then, we'll go have our core values. We'll get more into our business. So anything you guys want to hear, be sure to, let us know that. Send it to support@ccwsafe.com. We'll probably get a podcast email specifically for these shows.
Yes. Yeah. Just to cover also, just some of the basics. We came out and we began covering any use of force, which at the time everyone was just covering firearms.
Yep.
We went as a national product, all 50 states. We also had the only response element, and still, it's been 7 years, we still have the only response element, boots on the ground. We cover no caps on criminal and no caps on civil. People don't understand how important that is, because your defense actually matters. When you run out of money, although they say no out-of-pocket expenses, if you have a cap on your criminal defense, you're going to have some out-of-pocket. Because, most of these companies, they don't really give you the amount of money that you need, to actually defend a full-blown murder trial or death case.
Well, that's one thing that we have. One thing we talked about with Steven, just being able to get out of jail. What, how effective are you going to be if you can't get out of jail?
Correct.
Are you going to be able to work? Are you going to be able to make a living to pay that what you need to pay? And again, they say, well, there's no out-of-pocket. Well, I don't know any other companies that are there any that pay over over $500,000 or up to $1 million in bail?
No one does match our bail.
And if you are arrested on a self-defense shooting, especially if someone has died, I can pretty much guarantee you will have a $500,000 bail. There's a study. There's a good study that I can put in the show notes of this. We've talked about it before. It was actually by a liberal website that was doing a report, and it was basically on how unfair the U.S. bail system is and how peculiar it is because, you know, from starting from larceny up to, you know, all the charges from that all the way ranking up to rape were, you know, $5,000 to $250,000 bail. But then how unfair it was for those who are charged with murder because it jumps from to $500,000 to a million, which I don't really see a big problem with that if somebody is charged with murder or murder one or two or manslaughter. But, you know, if you can't cover that, then, you know, there's this fallacy, I think, with a lot of people that, well, you know, I'll just get out of jail. Well, first of all, you have to be granted a hearing by a judge to even see if you qualify to get out of jail. You may not qualify, and the prosecution can say, can rule against bail. And if the right. judge says, okay, then it doesn't matter if you have $100 million sitting in an account. You're not getting out of jail.
That's right.
So to be able to have $50,000, because on a $500,000 bail bond or bond setting, you're going to have to pay $50,000, generally 10%, but then you also have to make collateral. You have to meet the collateral. So if you don't have a house or property or any assets that equal $500,000, then you may not still be able to bond out. If you Absolutely. Do have that, or if you don't have any criminal, you know, criminal charge, criminal history, then you can be, but it's going to be a 10%, $50,000. And if you have, you know, $10,000 of bail bond coverage, then you're going to either have to pay the remaining $40,000 or, you know, if they'll let you take that out of whatever else you have, the other $150,000 you have for your trial, then you can roll out of that. But then now you're looking at, you know, $110,000 left or whatever, and then it's going to be gone pretty quick. And that what Stan was saying about it's important to know, it's important to take that into account, is it's very important because in Stephen's case, the attorneys themselves said, you know, if Stephen didn't have the resources from CCW Safe, it would have been normal, it would have been common, and it would have been acceptable for an attorney to say, hey, look, you got to plea this out because you don't have the money yeah. needed to fight
Absolutely.
This thing. And
yeah, because he was facing a life sentence.
Life sentence. And, you know, you want to plea out a life. I mean, can you even plea out a life sentence? But if you could, okay, 10 years, you know, 20 years, what's it going to take? And, you know, that's the bad thing with a lot of these insurance policies as well, is if you plea, then you're not going to get anything back because yeah. that's a guilty charge.
Yeah, they got some red tape in place that states that if you know, admit to, you know, or get convicted and, you know, even take a plea, that they can walk away from you and not give you any money or reimburse you. So they'll leave you hanging. You know, we don't do that here. Also, you know, when you talk about bail, like we were the first ones back in 2013. Number one, our standard was a $250,000 bail coverage. Mm-hmm. A lot of the companies had $100,000 coverage. I think there was only one that matched us with the $250,000. Mm-hmm. But then we quickly also jumped up and did a $1 million bond coverage, mm-hmm. which no one still has matched us to this date. There's only one that's given out $500,000 now as a bond, mm-hmm. and $500,000 is our standard as well. That's the beauty of CCW Safe, is that we continue to be flexible, and we learned a lot from the Maddox case. I mean, because like I said, it was, you know, the worst case scenario. And because of that, we knew the importance of making $500,000 the standard for our new plans, because if you get a $500,000 bond and we put up the $25,000 and we got a $250,000 bond or, you know, coverage, then you have to match our $25,000 to get out of jail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we care about our members more than that. So we want to, when you use our money, so we'd rather you use that to get out of jail than yours. So, I mean, it's just a thing of beauty, you know, what we've created.
Yeah. And it's good for the, it's really, if you think about it, I mean, it's good for the whole industry as far as a consumer, because you know, because of the coverage that we had when we come in, other companies started to up their coverage, which was better for
the
consumer.
They did.
And you know, when we feel like this, I feel like this, and I think our whole company is like this. There's plenty of room in this space. We're not, you know, we're not here to try to put other companies out of business. We're not here to you know, we get calls all the time from people, hey, tell me why I should choose you over this company, or what makes you better. And, you know, and you'll hear it often if you ask that question is, you know, we believe everybody in this space will do what they say they will do for their members. Here's what we do.
Absolutely.
And this is what sets us apart. And, so it's good for the consumer. Just like anything else, competition is good for the consumer because it brings forth better products, services, and coverages.
Absolutely. I mean, and it was needed change. I mean, the industry needed to change. They did pick up some things that were our standard. They did some other things that, you know, little marketing tricks, you know, because, you know, that they kind of adopted our critical response team verbiage. Mm-hmm. And they all did that without having a true response element. They do that by phone, and we actually do boots on the ground. But you got to keep your eyes open to, like, you know, everything that's out there, because, like I said, they will do everything they say that they would do, but we just have a lot more to offer, and we're pretty proud of that.
Yes. And that's something else we'll be covering too, is the critical response, because critical response is, the definitions are quite different, I think, that are out there,
yeah,
you know, in that sure, actual solutions. So another thing that I want to talk about right quick before we wrap this up, and mm-hmm, this is something that we'll actually talk to Don about, but one of the things that we learned early on too was that having a list of hundreds or thousands of attorneys really doesn't mean much. And we learned that through the Stephen Maddox case, is that we had an attorney, it happened in Wilson, North Carolina, close to Raleigh, North Carolina. And mm-hmm, when that happened, Don had already a attorney in Raleigh that was, oh, this guy, okay, I got the guy for this. This will be the guy, great guy to handle this case. So on a Saturday night when we got the call 11:45, by 1 o'clock the next day, we had boots on the ground in Wilson, North Carolina. And Don found out that attorney in Raleigh was on vacation out of the country for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's one thing people, and I've heard this by a lot of people who I respect a lot, but they just don't understand. They're like, well, I want to know what attorney you have. Well, okay, where's your shooting going to happen? Is it going to be in this county or that county? Are you going to be in state, out of state? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that go on that have to be taken into place. Yes. Number one, you know, these attorneys, the good attorneys are not sitting around waiting for you to call them and interview them about what may happen that may have a 2% chance of happening, if that, mm-hmm, in the future.
Mm-hmm.
These are busy guys. They're professional, experienced guys, and they're out working. And that's the thing. There's so many things, you know, if you know where your shooting's going to be in, you might want to stay home that day, because it's probably going to be a murder one charge right off if you knew that where it's going to happen. But the deal with the long list of attorneys is, you know, it doesn't matter until that incident happens. And knowing where that incident is, what county it's in, who knows the judges, procedures, prosecutors, the police investigators, all that's going to go into play. And like in the Maddox case, the two attorneys that we ended up hiring, Kurt Schmidt and Tart Thomas probably were not on the radar at all until that happened.
Correct.
But because that the attorney that Don had in mind was out of the country for 2 weeks, and we talked about this, I don't think Stephen wanted us to wait for 2 weeks. He was sitting in county jail. Those two attorneys ended up being the perfect attorneys for that case. So that's why you have to rely on people like Don West and his experience to be able to find that. Now, that's not saying that if you have a great attorney that you know when you sign up, send us their name, because we definitely want to reach out to them. But we are going to vet them, and we're going to make sure that, you know, your best interest is our best interest, and vice versa. And so that's how we look at our members and the coverage. And, you know, we're in this together, and we're going to fight hard. And, you know, we also learned early on, too, that it's better to fight hard and strong and pay what needs to be paid, even if it's a little more upfront, and to get it taken care of.
That's so true. You know, before you wrap up, you know, we just had a recent call. A member got into an incident, and we hired an attorney that was a former prosecutor there in that area. So what he did was that, you know, he got ahead of it, and he was familiar with his relationships with the law enforcement, and he went there and met with law enforcement and pretty much killed the case, you know, at the beginning, was able to show, you know, that it was self-defense. And they didn't present charges to the DA. So, I mean, it's really smart in the way that we do business, and we really do care. And we'll talk about it in the future. You know, hopefully Mike will allow us to, you know, he and I to break down our core values.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, but, you know, in one of these podcasts. But, you know, we really care about our members, and you guys really are family. And we absolutely appreciate the time that you get us. And that's the reason why we are taking our time and on our busy schedules to talk to you and let you get some more insight as to who we are and how we operate.
Yeah, and before we go, I do want everybody to know that our core values, commitment, dedication, experience, leadership, and caring. And, you know, that's not core values that Stan or I developed. That those were developed through our everybody at CCW Safe. It was a exercise we did that we learned from Ken Major in San Francisco, who that's what he does. And it develops a culture within the company internally for those inside personally, but also for the members or for externally toward the customers. So we'll go over that another time, but those are our core values. And this trial, you know, was one that we really saw all those core values come out, and we're about to release new videos from Stephen Maddox where he goes in and he talks about each core value and how he saw it play out in the trial, which is some really good video that we got this last week. So be looking forward to that. Yeah, we'll definitely go over, I think we'll probably have a podcast on each core value and kind of what it means to us internally, for ourselves personally, and for our members. So, you know, I think if that's it, Stan, I think it's a good first podcast for the Inside CCW Safe.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great just to get everybody to brush across our history and what we're all about. So I appreciate you reaching out to you, Mike, and giving me the opportunity to do this.
Yeah, and any questions you might have, comment on this. If you have any questions, we'll get them answered. We'll follow up next week's podcast. We're going to try to do them weekly. We may do them bi-weekly to start out, but eventually we will have a weekly podcast out. Now that we're still going to have our articles, we're still going to have the videos, we're still going to have courses come out. The next course that's going to be coming out on Academy will probably be the active shooter, run, hide, fight. But anyways, we're going to continue those. So this is just another aspect of us being able to get information out. All right, Stan, have a good day, man.
Okay. Okay, guys. Everybody be safe out there.
All right. Take care.